seeing that the expectation was that the Ben-Gurion airport would not return to normal operations in January as well, according to the Ynet News website. Pinchas Idan, chairman of the Workers' Committee, told Ynet News, "I pray that the war will end as soon as possible and that the work will return in full. We did the right thing because after COVID-19 pandemic, we drew conclusions." According to The Cradle, on 6th of November this year, the Financial Times published an extraordinary investigation tracking the devastating economic toll of Israel's war on Gaza, its impact reverberating across personal finances, job markets, businesses, industries, and the Israeli government itself. The Financial Times reports that the war had disrupted and ravaged thousands of companies, many teetering on the brink of collapse, with entire sectors plunged into an unprecedented crisis. Data cited from Israel's Central Bureau of Statistics reveal a bleak reality. One in three businesses in Israel have either shuttered or are operating at 20% capacity since Operational Axa Flood commenced on 7th of October and punched a hole in Israeli national confidence. More than half of businesses face revenue losses surpassing the 50% mark. The southern regions close to Gaza bear the brunt, with two-thirds of businesses either closed or functioning to a minimum. Adding to the crisis, Israel's labor ministry reports that 764,000 citizens, close to a fifth of Israel's workforce, are jobless due to evacuations, school closures, mandating childcare responsibilities, or reverse duty call-ups. Recently, the Bloomberg News Agency put numbers to the economic impact of Tel Aviv's military belligerence. The Gaza war has cost the Israeli economy almost $8 billion to date, with a further $260 million in losses occurred with every day that passes. Despite this, the dire situation, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is heavily reliant on support from right-wing, ultra-Zionist political factions, persists in allocating vast sums to non-essential ideological and settler colonial projects, diverging from the typical wartime economy protocol. Netanyahu has earmarked a record 14 billion shekels, or $3.6 billion, in discretionary spending for the five political parties comprising his coalition government, much of it intended for religious schools and the development of illegal Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. In a bitter irony of the war in Gaza, multiple Israeli construction projects have temporarily ground to a halt as they primarily relied on exploitation of Palestinian labourers. The Financial Times reports that Israelis are upset at the sight of Arab workers holding heavy tools, so they don't want to have Palestinian workers there. Such disenfranchisement comes despite many businesses being reduced to pleading for donations to remain afloat. Tourism, a potential economic lifeline, offers little respite for Tel Aviv. Figures from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, depict international travel contributing a mere 2.8% to Israel's gross domestic product and supporting 230,000 jobs, just over 6% of the total workforce. Despite persistent efforts throughout 2022 to revive tourism, October saw a massive 76% year-on-year decline in tourism. The onset of Al-Aqsa flood operation further decimated travel, with daily flights to and from Ben-Gurion Airport plummeting from 500 to a mere 100. The catastrophe unfolding is not lost on Tel Aviv's economists, 300 of which, on 1st of November, urged Prime Minister Netanyahu and his finance ministers to come to your senses due to the grave blow that Israel was dealt. They believe the cataclysm requires a fundamental change in national priorities and a massive rechanneling of funds to deal with war damage, aid to victims, and the rehabilitation of Israel's economy. Despite such rhetorical bombast, there are ample indications the Zionist regime is as dangerously deluded about its economic sustainability as its military prowess. Reports published by Tel Aviv's Startup Nation Policy Institute think tank reveal a grim outlook. Just 2 weeks after the Al-Aqsa flood operation erupted, the organization issued a study on damage to Israel's technology sector, once a source of national pride and joy, and a bellwether for its prosperity more generally. Even at that early stage, the Startup Nation Policy Institute forecast a rapidly impending economic crisis whose force is still unknown, based on its survey. In all, 80% of Israeli technology firms reported damage resulting from the country's worsening security situation, while a quarter recorded double damage, both in human resources and in obtaining investment capital. Over 40% of technology companies had investment agreements delayed or cancelled, or just 10% were in managing to have meetings with their investors. The uncertainty and the resulting decision of many investors to sit on the fence due to the current situation hits an ecosystem that was already struggling to raise capital, partially due to the potential instability on the eve of the war, combined with a worldwide economic recession. Another reason for the Israeli technology sector's failure, unmentioned by the S&P, but investigated by the Cradle on 13th of October, is the exposure of Tel Aviv's electronic surveillance and warfare system vulnerabilities by Al-Aqsa flood operation. That report concluded that Palestinian resistance operation would likely lead to a significant decline in the fortunes of Israel's cybersecurity sector, given it represents a grave and potentially terminal blow to the Startup Nation brand, which relies heavily on cybersecurity. The subsequent events have borne out this prediction.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Muslim Lady from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Umabiha Mukhtar. And our guest today is Sister Salma Khalfan, an Islamic researcher who is going to enlighten us about hijab according to the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. Salamun alaikum and welcome, Sister Salma.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for coming. What has Ayatollah Khamenei got to mention about the relationship between men and women regarding the aspect of hijab?
Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Khamenei says that men and women are required to observe a limit in the relationship. Very good point here. He says also, look at his broad-mindedness in this aspect. He says that they can talk to one another. They can do even business with one another. Yeah. And they can also argue one another. They can be a teacher of one another. Okay? Either man to a woman or woman to a man.
Yeah.
But within a limit. But there are limits that they must observe. And this is an Islamic rule to observe limitations, that is. And it should be observed overstepping the limits, destroying woman's human dignity. That means if one oversteps the limits, yeah, he destroys the woman's dignity in turn. And then this woman who engaged too much, you know, by interacting with men, either as a friend, as a business partner, as a student or a teacher, if she oversteps her limit and isn't concerned about the, you know, the way she talks or the way she, the mode of her voice, her tone, and, you know, how she makes jokes or, you know, that is all exceeding limit, then she becomes an object of pleasure.
Oh.
Yeah. And using them, and becomes like a means of marketing. Marketing them and their flashy ornaments are prohibited in Islam.
I think I remember an example to this where there was a boxer, you know, before boxing matches, they have these women who come and like kind of walk around in very skimpy clothing. And he said that, look, I don't want these women to come before my match. He was a Muslim boxer. And he said, because I feel this is just, you know, I don't want women to show off their bodies. I don't feel this is, you know, respectful to a woman. After this, a woman comes and says, this is their job. They're supposed to come and look beautiful before the scene. After that, so many people were saying, this is exactly what kind of disregard, like degrades a woman, you know, that what is she, an object where people are supposed to just look at her beauty? This is exactly what is happening right now, where women are looked at as just objects. They think they're being empowered because, you know, they're now given equal rights, supposedly. But then, at the same time, they're also being really looked down upon as just objects of pleasure.
Yeah, and the beauty will, you know, fade away.
Yeah.
And then they won't be respected then because they won't have that beauty. Whereas Allah wants that inner beauty to shine, right?
Yes, exactly.
The woman's real worth to come out. So Ayatollah keeps on saying that Islam says that women should increase their honor and dignity. That is their inner beauty. They should see in what mode they should they interact with the man.
Yeah.
Women are advised to achieve enough honor and dignity. That means they should have that izzat enafs in them. Okay?
What's izzat enafs?
Izzat enafs is something that you respect yourself.
Hmm.
When you respect yourself, you don't want to mingle, overreact. You want to see how you talk, what you talk, in what manner you talk,
yeah,
and how long you talk. What kind of a relationship with men do you have? Do you have an over-friendly relationship? All this pertains to a woman's real, real character of her, how she respects herself. True. If she overdoes it.
Yeah.
But if she does it to the right proportion and when it's necessary, then it is allowed. Like the way Ayatollah Khamenei says, she should be very, you know, like careful whether she's being watched by a man or not. This is the relationship, okay? And there's a lot of difference between these ideal Muslim women and women who painstakingly select their clothes, their makeup, and their gait in order to attract a person. There's so much difference, he says, from a woman who is dignified and virtuous and thinks of her dignity and has izzat enough,
yeah,
than the woman who chooses just hours on to, you know, portray herself when she's going to a place, that what she'll wear, what makeup she'll put on. All this is a wastage of time for her if she's doing it for an mahram, right?
It's true. And I think this is the whole, you know, behind the scenes kind of plans happening. If hijab becomes so prominent where now, you know, women are not so out there trying to work on different kinds of makeup products, you know, to make themselves look as flashy or beautiful outside, this million-dollar industry of makeup will go really low. The business of makeup is so high that so many businesses will flop if women stop using makeup. Like, this is a whole scheme that's going on. And
yeah, it's a plan, a strategy.
It's really very interesting. So we're just going to take a small brief intermission and we'll be continuing shortly.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady. And today we have been discussing about what Ayatollah Khamenei has got to mention about the relationship between men and women. And Sister Salma, you have told us that it's important for a man and a woman to, you know, stay and observe the limits between themselves, and that it's okay for them to have some sort of relation and
but that within the limits of chastity.
Yes, between the limits of chastity.
Further on says that Ayatollah Khamenei, that the existence of a distance between men and women is itself a primary principle, and it is not a matter of wearing a chadar only, a veil only. That distance should be maintained. You know, naturally, as we pointed out in our previous session, that women are inclined to be chaste.
Yeah.
So that chastity begins from the inside. And you will see that even women who don't wear hijab and they're good people, they're good women, they will always refrain from having friendly relation with a man.
Yeah.
And they will always be shy in front of the opposite sex because they will want to maintain that izzat and nafs, that dignity of theirs, that respect within themselves. That if they talk, they don't want to be looked upon with, you know, those kind of eyes that will give her a bad image in herself. And she's judged by her beauty. No, and she wants to be respected.
Yeah, and I think when women say, you know, oh, we don't want to be catcalled outside, we don't want people to look at us the way they're looking.
It's become so opposite, right?
Yeah, so it's kind of like if you don't want something to happen to you, then you have to try and do the things necessary. If I don't want to be catcalled outside, I would try and, you know, cover myself. It's for myself. It's not for them. It's for myself. Like, I don't want this to happen to me. So I feel like that kind of distinction is kind of not looked at nowadays. That, oh, they should cover themselves. They should look down. They should not watch me. If I should be
free. I should fit in the society. And everybody is not observing, so I should also observe.
Yeah.
In Western countries, for example,
even
some Muslim women do that. You know, they feel that I'll be the odd one out.
True.
They don't know that this is just giving herself that image that will destroy her, her generations, her virtues, her taqwa, or, you know, her piety. This
very
is so
true.
Important. So Ayatollah Khamenei beautifully says that with this hijab, you can achieve that loftier achievements of taqwa, virtues, good generation, you know, respect, all these things. It is related to our values. Observing hijab helps women achieve a high spiritual position and avoid common pitfalls. And that is why Ayatollah says that I stress on hijab so much. What a beautiful way of expressing that, you know, a man is so concerned about his society that he's saying that I'm so concerned that's why I stress on hijab so much.
Yeah, he's so caring for us. I feel like we kind of confuse that with, oh, he's so overbearing, you know. Like, why
is he
forcing this on us? You know, this is against the freedom that, you know, the West or the people out
there.
Or
it's an Iranian law, rather. It's an Islamic law, right?
It's an Islamic
law. In the Quran.
Like, Allah, our creator, has, you know, said this is how we should be. This is what we should do for our benefit, for our safety. But we tend to forget that. So let's just take a quick break and we'll be back soon, inshallah. Okay. Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady, and we have been discussing with Sister Salma about Ayatollah Khamenei's views on the relationship between men and women regarding the aspect of hijab. And she has mentioned very important points, one of which is because a woman wants to strive to, you know, attain that higher spiritual position, which hijab kind of gives that path for her to reach. I think we would like to ask you another question, if you don't mind. Does he mention more about why a woman should observe this code of dress as per the Islamic Sharia?
Yes, he does. In fact, he says showing off one's physical attraction is prohibited in Islam.
Okay.
You know, normally a woman has this tendency of wanting to show her beauty.
Yeah.
When she does that, because Allah has created her in such a beautiful form, in comparison to men, of course, she's more beautiful. So, because of that, Allah says that I don't want men to take advantage of you.
Yeah.
So now it's prohibited for you in Islam. It's a law in Islam, not only in, you know, like a national level of Iran. No,
yeah.
It's a law in Islam to hide your beauty in a way that you neutralize that so that your real worth shows through your character, personality, your attributes, you know. And this is very important to everyone. If you go and see, even if a doctor, she doesn't need to beautify herself. When the people know that she's a doctor, they will look at her up to her with through her, you know, this her being a doctor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So not her being a woman as such. They will just call her even a doctor. But a woman who, you know, appears fashionably and displays her beauty, then even that doctorate won't show of hers.
True.
You know, only her beauty will show. And she would not like that also. Would a woman like that she be judged by her outer beauty rather than her qualifications?
No. In fact, this is supposedly their claims today that, oh, we want to be seen as who we are. We want, you know, to do this work and this work so that, you know, we're not the lower gender,
yeah,
you know.
They're so naive. They fail to understand that that is not through the outer beauty. It's through the inner beauty, right?
Yeah.
So His Eminence says that in Islam, women have been prohibited from showing off their beauty in order to attract men or cause fitna. Again, the word fitna comes here. That is, in order to cause temptation. Here it means temptation.
Yeah.
Showing off one's physical attraction to men is a kind of temptation to men. And it can cause various problems. And so many problems, I believe. It is not a matter of a young girl or boy committing a sin. In fact, he says this is the first, and maybe it's a small problem. Because it's starting with that, you know.
True.
But it ends with what? Because we know shaitan gets through what? Step by step. Khutuwati shaitan. In the Quran it says that he gets you step by step. The consequences, he says, the consequences will affect the family and the society. That's very important. Basically, such unprincipled relationship between men and women is a deadly poison that can affect the health of the family, the well-being of the family. That is because of the survival of family depends on love,
yeah,
not on beauty.
Like what you said, it's like a dominoes effect, you know? Because when a woman is unchaste, it kind of brings this temptation, as you said. You know, the men, their focus goes into these kind of things after their carnal desires. You know, marriage is now done very late. You
know, regarded as secondary.
Yeah. Yeah, and then marriages are late, you know, and then marriages are weak, and then there's more, you know,
breakup of marriages.
Yeah, breakups. And all of this is kind of breaking the society.
Yes.
And if you look at the West right now, which is right, why we are bringing the West so much right now is because it's kind of looked at as the ideal society.
Yes.
How much has it collapsed at this moment?
Yes.
And the woman is such a vital role. I feel like we kind of forget the woman's role over here.
Other than the framework of the family, the stability of the family will be undermined, leading to the situation that Western countries are currently suffering from, as you stated.
Very true, very true. This was very enlightening, and thank you very much for your valuable time. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening. This was Hijab with Sister Salma Khalfan, and we will see you in the next episode, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing. everything in life is free.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. This is how Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, enlightens us regarding the mission of her father, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Allah has sent Muhammad as perfection for his commands, a resolution to accomplish his rule, and an implementation of the decrees of his mercy. So he found the nations to vary in their faiths, obsessed by their fires, worshipping their idols, and denying Allah despite their knowledge of him. Therefore, Allah illuminated their darkness with my father, Muhammad, uncovered obscurity from their hearts, and cleared the clouds from their insights. He revealed guidance among the people, so he delivered them from being led astray, led them away from misguidance, guided them to the proper religion, and called them to the straight path.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
They are heroes. Dear child, it is past midnight. I'm flying at hundreds of miles an hour in the darkness, thousands of feet over the Atlantic Ocean. I'm traveling to Egypt. I will go to the border of Gaza at Rafah. I go because of you. You have never been in a plane. You have never left Gaza. You know only the densely packed streets and alleys, the concrete hovels. You know only the security barriers and fences patrolled by soldiers that surround Gaza. Planes for you are terrifying. Fighter jets, attack helicopters, drones. They circle above you. They drop missiles and bombs, deafening explosions. The ground shakes. Buildings fall. The dead, the screams, the muffled calls for help from beneath the rubble. It does not stop, night and day. Trapped under the piles of smashed concrete, your playmates, your schoolmates, your neighbors, gone in seconds. You see the chalky faces and limp bodies when they are dug out. I am a reporter. It is my job to see this. You are a child. You should never see this. Stench of death, rotting corpses under the broken concrete. You hold your breath. You cover your mouth with a cloth. You walk faster. Your neighborhood has become a graveyard. All that was familiar is gone. You stare in amazement. You wonder where you are. You are afraid. Explosion after explosion. You cry. You cling to your mother or father. You cover your ears. You see the white light of the missile and wait for the blast. Why do they kill children? What did you do? Why can't anyone protect you? Will you be wounded? Will you lose a leg or an arm? Will you go blind or be in a wheelchair? Why were you born? Was it for something good? Or was it for this? Will you grow up? Will you be happy? What will it be like without your friends? Who will die next? Your mother? Your father? Your brothers and sisters? Someone you know will be injured soon. Someone you know will die soon. At night you lie in the dark on the cold cement floor. The phones are cut. The internet is off. You do not know what is happening. There are flashes of light. There are waves of blast concussions. There are screams. It does not stop. When your father or mother hunts for food or water, you wait. That terrible feeling in your stomach. Will they come back? Will you see them again? Will your tiny home be next? Will the bombs find you? Are these your last moments on earth? You drink salty, dirty water. It makes you very sick. Your stomach hurts. You are hungry. The bakeries are destroyed. There is no bread. You eat one meal a day, pasta, a cucumber. Soon, this will seem like a feast. You do not play with your soccer ball made of rags. You do not fly your kite made from old newspapers. You have seen foreign reporters. We wear flak jackets with the word press written on them. We have helmets. We have cameras. We drive jeeps. We appear after a bombing or a shooting. We sit over a coffee for a long time and talk to the adults. Then we disappear. We do not usually interview children. But I have done interviews when groups of you crowded around us, laughing, pointing, asking us to take your picture. I have been bombed by jets in Gaza. I have been bombed in other wars, wars that happened before you were born. I, too, was very, very scared. I still have dreams about it. When I see the pictures of Gaza, these wars return to me with a force of thunder and lightning. I think of you. All of us who've been to war hate war most of all because of what it does to children. I tried to tell your story. I tried to tell the world that when you are cruel to people, week after week, month after month, year after year, decade after decade, when you deny people freedom and dignity, when you humiliate and trap them in an open-air prison, when you kill them as if they were beasts, they become very angry. They do to others what was done to them. I told it over and over. I told it for 7 years. Few listened. And now this. There are very brave Palestinian journalists. 50 of them have been killed since this bombing began. They are heroes. So are the doctors and nurses in your hospitals. So are the UN workers, almost 100 of whom have been killed. So are the ambulance drivers and medics. So are the rescue parties that lift up the slabs of concrete with their hands. So are the mothers and fathers who shield you from the bombs. But we are not there. Not this time. We cannot get in. We are locked out. Reporters from all over the world are going to the border crossing at Rafah. We are going because we cannot watch this slaughter and do nothing. We are going because hundreds of people are dying a day, including over 100 children. We are going because this genocide must stop. We are going because we have children, like you, precious, innocent, loved. We are going because we want you to live. I hope one day we will meet. You will be an adult. I will be an old man, although to you I am already very old. In my dream for you, I will find you free and safe and happy. No one will be trying to kill you. You will fly in airplanes filled with people, not bombs. You will not be trapped in a concentration camp. You will see the world. You will grow up and have children. You will become old. You will remember this suffering. But you will know it means you must help others who suffer. This is my hope, my prayer. We have failed you. This is the awful guilt we carry. We tried, but we did not try hard enough. We will go to Rafah, many of us, reporters. We will stand outside the border with Gaza and protest. We will write and film. This is what we do. It is not much, but it is something. You will tell your story again. Maybe it will be enough to earn the right to ask for your forgiveness. Thank you.
Today's special. Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers, dear sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio from Iran. In this episode, we're going to look at the high status of Lady Fatima, peace be upon her.
Daughter of the Nabi, Lady Fatima.
Today, Thursday, is the 7th of Jamadi Uthani, 1445 of the Islamic Lunar History Calendar, corresponding to the 30th of Azar, 1402 of the Islamic Solar History Calendar, and the 21st of December, 2023 of the Christian Gregorian Calendar. This is Chapter Al-Imran, verse 61.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. فَمَنْ حَاجَّكَ فِيهِ مِنْ بَعْدِ مَا جَاءَكَ مِنَ الْعِلْمِ فَقُلْ تَعَالَوْا نَدْعُ أَبْنَاءَنَا وَأَبْنَاءَكُمْ وَنِسَاءَنَا وَنِسَاءَكُمْ وَأَنفُسَنَا وَأَنفُسَكُمْ ثُمَّ نَبْتَهِلْ فَنَجْعَلْ لَعْنَةَ اللَّهِ عَلَى الْكَاذِبِينَ.
Then whoever argues with you about it after this knowledge has come to you, say, come, let us call our sons and your sons, our women and your women, ourselves and yourselves, then supplicate earnestly together and invoke the curse of Allah upon the liars among us.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
It is recited that the Christian of Najran set out a religious mission to attend Medina and discuss with the Prophet. After some debates, they felt hesitation and sought for pretext. Then they were called for mubahala. This is any curse which would reach either of two parties showed that that party was not right. On the day of cursing, they saw the Prophet, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, enter the appointed spot, followed by Hassan, Hussein, Ali, and Fatima. When the chief monk saw them, he exclaimed, "By God, I see the faces that if they pray to God for mountains to move from their places, the mountains will immediately move. If they curse you, you will be wiped out of the existence to the last day of the life of the earth." Therefore, they were ready for compromise.
Ya Fatima al-Zahra, ya bint Muhammad, ya qurrata.
Shfa'i lana
can learn about high status of Lady Fatima. Fatima was the highest example in chastity, honor, and veiling for all Muslim women. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, once a blind man asked permission to visit Fatima, but she asked him to stay behind a curtain. The Messenger of Allah asked Fatima, why did you screen him, though he's blind and could not see you? She said, he could not see me, but I could see him. The Prophet said, I witnessed that you are apart from me. Once Imam Ali asked Fatima, when is women closer to her Lord? She said, when she keeps to her house. Imam Ali offered her answer to Prophet, who said, she is true. Fatima is part from me.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. In this first session, we shall be talking about the importance of Fatimiyya and the effect of the whole existence of Lady Fatima salamullah alayha in the world of Shi'ism and the importance of the mourning and azadari on Lady Fatima salamullah alayha. But let's have a look at the function of the Fatimiyya and Fatimiyya days. Fatimiyya has a function of global dimensions and can save the school of Ahlul Bayt and Islam from cultural and social crises in today's world, because in these days we are witnessing the establishment of Fatimi University, where the Islamic way of life in the personal, social, and political spheres for all people are being delivered, especially Muslim women and girls are explained. Now we are going to refer to some of the examples regarding the functionality of Fatimiyya. So we want to say that the functionality of Fatimiyya is of high importance, and we can refer to some of the famous. The first example that we want to refer to is the role modeling in Islamic society, and we shall be talking again right after that about promoting the culture of chastity and hijab and the status and position of women in political struggles, which is to some extent talking about the social aspect of Fatimiyya.
IRIB English Radio. Recitation as well as translation of Quran.
وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا مُوسَى الْكِتَابَ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَهْتَدُونَ.
And we certainly gave Moses the scripture that perhaps they would be guided.
Short commentary of the Quran. Islamic issues.
Institution of the family in Islam is the most beloved by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
The life of the infallible.
فجرا جئت بعد العسر يسرا ربنا أعلاك قدرا يا إمام.
All in all, in today's special IRIB English Radio.
From beautiful lessons from the epic life of Fatima Zahra, we reach to standing up for justice in our community. O people of understanding, supporters of faith and defenders of Islam, what is the cause of this negligence in defending my rights and laxity before the injustice being done to me? Shortly after the death of the Holy Prophet, the rights of the inheritance of Fatima Zahra were taken away. In response, Fatima delivered a famous sermon condemning the injustice. This was not for her own worldly gain, but to uphold justice and declare her rights. Knowing the asceticism of Fatima, it is understood that she did not care for this inheritance, for its material value, yet she still stood up for her rights. The lessons from this stance are critical, as they highlight to us. The maintaining justice is critical and should never be overlooked.
Ya Allah. Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Allah.
Fatima Zahra, in the view of Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Fatima Zahra, the young lady with a lofty position equal to saints and prophets. She was a young woman who enjoyed such a lofty position of spirituality, which was equal to prophets and like, and she was called the mistress of all women by divine messengers. Besides this spiritual position, each outstanding characteristics and each important role in the personal life of this great lady is a lesson. The spiritual positions of Fatima Zahra, God's greeting be upon her, are among the best spiritual positions which belong only to a few individuals. She was infallible. Infallibility is particular to a few individuals who are chosen by Allah, and that great Hazrat Fatima Zahra, God's greetings be upon her, is one of these few individuals.
Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, he says, I would see my mother on a Thursday night. She stands in her mihrab, and the whole night she's praying until her feet would swell. And I hear her praying dua, doing dua for the neighbors. So later on I come to her, I tell her, Ummah, O mother, you did dua for this person and that person. She tells him, yes, O my dear son, waladi, al-jar thumma ad-dar. You do dua for the neighbor, and then you do dua for yourself. This sacrifice was incorporated, and it became a part of her children. And this was something that Fatima Zahra and Amir al-Mu'mineen, they did as parents. Today, my dear brothers and sisters, as parents, we have to ask ourselves, what are we teaching our children? What are we doing? Are we fulfilling our duties and our responsibilities? Not by telling them, just do this and do that. No, by teaching them, by becoming role models as parents. They were role models. When she was a wife, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, he says, Wallah ma aghdabatni. He says, Wallah, she never angered me. She never upset me. She never raised her voice at me. And I never raised my voice at her. And this was a memory that Amir al-Mu'mineen had 30 years later. He tells Ammar and he tells his companions. They see him, he's still in sadness. They tell him, what's wrong? He says, I'm still sad. I'm still grieving the death of Fatima. They tell him, why? He says, because Fatima, she never upset me. She never angered me. She never hurt me. And I never angered her. We lived a beautiful life with one another. Even though it was filled with turbulence, even though it was filled with difficulties and challenges, yet it was a beautiful life. This was Fatima alayhi salam. After the death of Rasulullah, Fatima Zahra, her life flipped upside down. 180 degrees. Where she was the daughter of the Prophet, the one who Rasulullah would stand in front of her house every day. As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa ma'dan al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaika. Rasulullah would teach Fatima Zahra the essence of worship. He taught her something that we cherish, that's a part of in the heart and in the mind of every mu'min after every prayer. The Tasbihat al-Zahra. Tasbihat al-Zahra is what Fatima al-Zahra gave to us. It's the gift of Fatima to us.
Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for choosing this episode of today's special for listening. And till another episode, we leave you in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Allahumma salli ala Fatimata wa abiha. Allahumma salli ala Fatimata wa abiha.
وبعلها وبنيها بعدد ما أحاط به علمك. اللهم صل على فاطمة وأبيها وبعلها وبنيها بعدد ما أحاط به علمك.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.